The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. There is no doubt that we are in the data economy and that economy is fueled by a massive growth in data. Between 2011 and 2020, the data sphere, or the volume of data in the world, increased from 1.8 to 59 zettabytes. One zettabyte is 1 billion terabytes. By 2025, the data sphere is expected to grow to 175 zettabytes. If that seems like a lot, just consider that the average person on an average day consumes about 34 gigabits of data. Now, compare that consumption to the marvel of its day, the computer aboard the Apollo 11. That computer had a 2048-word memory, which could be used to store temporary results. In addition, it only had about 72 kilobytes of read-only memory. That should provide some perspective on how fast not only the data sphere has grown, but also our own use of the data. Data growth is a direct consequence of advances in technology ranging from the smartphone to the Internet of Things devices. It has also fueled the rise of tech behemoths like Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. We even have a term for it, big data. Everyone collects data, from the government to your neighborhood retail stores. The assumption seems to be the more data, the better. However, it is not that simple. Consider this. In July 2012, the Boston Mayor's Office, in response to complaints about the state of the city's roads, launched a new project called Street Bump. This was an app that allowed drivers to automatically report the road hazards to the city using their smartphone. Basically, the app automatically registered the location of a pothole to the city as soon as a driver felt that unfortunate thud. The findings were curious, though, as most of the city's potholes seemed to be in the affluent neighborhoods. That is, until someone questioned whether the demographics of smartphone ownership and usage would bias the data collection towards the more affluent inhabitants. Too often, our approach to big data and machine learning lacks a critical thinking framework, making us prone to common pitfalls and unintended consequences. What is needed is critical thinking skills when employing data science.
Alistair Kroll is an author, entrepreneur, event organizer, and speaker. He has authored 4 books on technology and entrepreneurship, including the best-selling Lean Analytics, which has been translated into 8 languages and is in its 10th printing in China. As a regular contributor to Substack, he writes about the intersection of tech and society. As an entrepreneur, Alistair has co-founded web performance startup CoRadiant, the Year One Labs incubator, and several other early stage companies. Alistair also founded and chaired some of the world's leading technology conferences, including Strata, Cloud Connect, Forward 50, BitNorth, ScaleTech, and Startup Fest. He speaks internationally on topics such as data science, innovation, scaling startups, digital government, AI, and applying critical thinking to technology. A graduate of Dalhousie University, Alistair has also been a visiting executive at Harvard Business School, where he helped create and teach the HBS course, Data Science and Critical Thinking. Welcome, Alistair.
Thanks for having me.
So you taught at a Harvard Business School course about data science and critical thinking. How did that come about, and what did you learn in teaching that course?
Well, a good friend of mine, Lutz Finger, was teaching it, and he wasn't able to continue. He had other commitments. And so I worked with a professor named Srikant Datar, who teaches design as well as in the business school. And we put together a curriculum for MBAs just to get them to think a little more critically about the data that on which they were making business decisions.
Very cool. One of the interesting things about teaching classes, of course, is there's what your students learn and what you learn. Did you learn anything particular in that experience?
I learned a lot about life on campus and free discourse, which is a politically charged topic. Ironically, when you're trying to get people to think critically about things, they are often self-censor. And so what the students actually think and what they're willing to say in a public classroom are two different things. I also learned that there are a lot of technologists going to business school. far fewer than I see business students learning technology, which is fascinating.
Interesting. And switching gears just a little bit, with so much of our lives already comfortably automated, does understanding the critical thinking framework, such as you taught in that class, when it comes to data generated by all this technology, is it really matter? Does it really matter for the average user?
Well, I think we shouldn't call them users. We should just call them people. We live more than half of our lives, particularly during the last year, online. We are digital creatures first in many ways, and we haven't noticed it. It's kind of snuck up on us. The problem with that is that there are things in the digital world that are economically different from the physical world. We're meeting right now virtually, and so this could be a recording. It could be somebody else using some technology to impersonate my voice. So veracity is really expensive. How do you prove it's me? Whereas if we're in person, you can look at me and go, yeah, that's him. On the other hand, personalization is incredibly expensive in the real world. Once upon a time, we had 3 or 4 broadsheet newspapers per major metropolis. And so you had a one-to-many kind of broadcast model. Today, Facebook generates 1 billion custom news feeds every hour. And so I think we haven't really internalized the things that were abundant that are now scarce and therefore expensive, and the things that were once scarce that are now abundant, therefore cheap. And that leads us to make bad decisions. We tend to trust things we see too much because we're acting on the real world risk calculus rather than the digital world risk calculus.
I'm putting that together with your comment of what the students were willing to say or unwilling to say, you know, the self-censorship as you described it. And I wonder if there's some way that that comes into play as well, in terms of what is now scarce versus what is now very cheap, right? And the fact that so much goes on publicly in environments like Facebook and whatnot, where perhaps people are likely to self-censor, whereas at the same time, it's hard to determine whether or not the public figures really are public figures.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely changes in the social dynamics. First of all, the systems we use, obviously, as you've covered on Tech Sequences in the past, they favor extreme responses and amplification. That's the sort of underlying proof of work of a social network. And as a result, we are being gradually rewarded for more extreme viewpoints, positive or negative, as well as finding like-minded individuals so we can have our biases confirmed.
Given that we're in a big data world and that so much data is being created, it is almost automatic for us to think, well, you know, there's so much data already, this is going to take care of itself. Why do we really need to think about critical thinking? For example, why do we really need to frame, what question we're trying to ask? Wouldn't it be obvious, because there's so much data already, I'm sure there's some nugget in there that if we apply the right algorithm, it's going to give us the answer. What would you say to that?
First, I'd say, who's writing the algorithm? Uh-huh. You mentioned some Boston issues. I'll give you another example. When Amazon launched Prime in Boston, they did it based on where people who bought a lot of products lived. And once again, they created a giant donut that ignored Black neighborhoods in Boston. There are a lot of times where the question you should have asked is not obvious until you start asking questions. And those questions can lead you down a rat hole. I talked to the American Library Association a few years ago, and I pointed out that librarians have almost a Hippocratic oath. Librarians are trained to bring you the information you sought. So if I go into a library and say, bring me all the books proving the earth is flat, they'll go find those. Mm-hmm. Now we have 1 billion bad librarians. And so the Hippocratic of the oath of the librarian kind of has to change to become, bring me information that will help me make factual decisions, because the library used to be the first place we went to look for data. Now it's the last. And so I think even the role of the information professional has changed. We used to have Walter Cronkite and we would trust his thoughts, right? Yeah. Today, we don't have the professional class of trust. And that is an epistemic crisis in democracy that we are going to have to be much more resilient with, because the freer a society, the more free speech that society has, the greater the attack surface for those who would do us harm or mess with our lives. And we used to talk about people going to war on the front lines, but the front line is on everyone's screen right now. We're all on the front lines. For every news story you hear about a SolarWinds hack or some kind of interference or bots amplifying polarized viewpoints to sow dissent, there's dozens that we don't hear about or we aren't aware of. And the holes in any political system that's based on collective understanding of the truth are a huge vulnerability for our enemies. And I think that's why critical thinking about data in general, not just whether it informs our lives, but what we believe to be true and how we know what truth is a skill that we need to learn almost as a form of digital self-defense. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite books is by Carl Sagan. I mean, I keep thinking about this book because it is such a great book. It's he wrote it in 1996, before all of this happened, you know, before fake news. And one of the chapters in that book is called, excuse my language, the bullshit detection chapter. And there are a couple of really great rules that he talks about. So for example, when you were talking about the librarian, going to the librarian, asking her or him to bring me all of the books about, you know, the earth is flat. One of the things he says is, you know, you really need to test more than one hypothesis. Think about all the different ways that a phenomenon can be explained, and then you want to systematically test them. All of this, I think, again, harks back to, you know, we talk about data science, but this harks back to a scientific way of thinking. Isn't that right?
It does, but that's a lot of work. You got to remember that humans are satisficing creatures. We're constantly trying to come up with easiest answer. And in many cases, one of my favorite authors on the subject, Jonathan Haidt, who wrote The Righteous Mind, talks about how we didn't evolve to be correct. We evolved to get the approval of our peers so that we'd be protected from the mammoth or, you know, given some of the food. And the way in which we try to make decisions is so governed by social approval, by peer feedback, by theory of mind, by what others think of us. And that's possibly one of the things that makes us a sentient species, is the theory of mind of others, but it's also a great vulnerability.
So why is it called data science?
Well, the scientific method is this idea of experimentation and verification or repudiation. It's an iterative process. Science does itself a disservice by saying science isn't truth, because science is always trying to disprove itself if you're doing it right. Data science is experimentation. And I think one of the things you have to realize about science is that knowledge comes in two forms. There's normative knowledge, which is what we know from the past. And there's formative knowledge, which is what we haven't yet discovered. If you take a tool like GPT-3, which you can train on billions and billions of things, and then ask it to create a data set, it'll be pretty good. It'll generate content that looks almost human. But if I took a GPT-3 trained data science or data system, let's say I took it from April 1st, it was generated on April 1st, and then I ask it a question about George Floyd, it's not going to know what happened yesterday when Chauvin was found guilty on all counts, because it wasn't trained on that. And so algorithms and data science are only as good as the past. They are based on the premise that the future will be like the past, only more so. But the rate of change,
retrospective.
Absolutely, they're retrospective. And the rate of change that we see in society with technology, the rate at which culture spreads around the world in a day rather than a year or a lifetime, means that information becomes stale very, very quickly. The rate of, as Alexa said in the introduction, the sheer volume of data means that the best by date of information is very, very short, which means that humans kind of have a role. We're the dumb fly in the ointment. We're the thing that doesn't do what it's supposed to do. We're the thing that finds the new way. We are formative to AI's normative. And this sort of chimeric future that we're moving towards, I think if we get it right, will be humans doing stupid shit, some of which works. And then it becomes part of the greater algorithm, because science has this idea of hypothesis and experimentation. And data science is as much about finding the unknown unknowns, the things you didn't know, as it is about finding the known unknowns, which is just writing a report. So when you hear about someone in business analytics generating a report, that's not really data science. But when they're running an experiment and they find something that looks promising and they find a weird correlation or anomaly and dig into it, and then turn that into a product or an algorithm, that's how we go from data science to data engineering.
So I get that on the at the level of sort of analyzing the larger space and avoiding the kinds of, well, detecting first and then avoiding the kinds of problems you outlined with the Amazon Prime planning process. But the average person is not gonna, you know, is not gonna start thinking that way. But at the same time, the average person does have to deal with this onslaught of data information and, you know, cultural shifts in their news feeds, talking to their neighbors over the fence, so on and so forth. So what can the average person do in terms of sort of improving their critical thinking and dealing with this massively data world?
Well, one of the things we came up with in the HBS course is this sort of life cycle of data. The first part of that is collecting the information. Where does it come from? How do you know it came from there? Is it structured in a way that can be analyzed and so on? The second is like storing it and cleaning it. Where does it live? How do you make sure that it doesn't get tampered with? How do you write it into some kind of permanent store? Then there's the act of processing and questioning it. So what you extract from it, and are you extracting it the right way? Is the algorithm that you're using wrong? And finally, there's what you do with it, which might be making a decision about whether or not to bring an umbrella to work, something as mundane as that, or it could be something as advanced as launching a company on it, or making a chart that shows people what you've learned. And I think it's really important to break everything up into those four sections of like the provenance of the data, the storage of the data, the analysis of the data, and the acting on the data. I think anything you're doing as a citizen, you can think about that, whether it's looking at a tweet or whether you're a business leader trying to make decisions based on what your team's told you.
Right. So the next time I see a tweet that makes me really, really mad, I should stop and analyze whether or not its provenance is reliable and so on and so forth before I start massively retweeting it and otherwise going off the rails.
Yeah. And I think you should also take a deep breath and ask yourself, why does this make me mad? Because you are at least half of that equation. Mm-hmm. And then say, what does the person who shared this information have as their objective? Do they want fame or recognition or anger or loyalty or to sell you something? Why is always a very good question to ask. I raised my 10-year-old daughter watching Scooby-Doo because I wanted her to learn that most of the time it's the guy who owns the circus in a rubber mask.
In your course at Harvard Business School, one of the themes that came up was about bias. How we actually program our bias and how in structuring this data, in setting up the critical thinking framework, we've got to be conscious of, let's say, you know, when you said collecting data, well, we could have confirmation bias in collecting that data. What are some of the common biases that you've seen really programmed already in a lot of, let's say, you know, machine learning programs we use or things that we rely on every day? And then second part of that question is, what if any changes do we need to make to the curriculum that is being taught to business school folks and developers to make sure that they are also apprehensive or conscious of and can recognize? Because one of the problems about bias is we don't recognize it. You know, we don't know that it's there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, first of all, it shouldn't be business school folks, it should be preschool folks. I think we got to be teaching this stuff as a survival skill, because this is really the first sort of generation that's digitally native.
You know, it's almost like we were taught home ec back in the day, right?
Absolutely. This is the modern version of home ec.
Yes.
And it's digital hygiene instead of personal hygiene. Mm. So there's a lot of biases. I mean, people often talk about confirmation bias, which is just, I'll believe things that I've seen before. One of the best people on this subject is a guy named David McCraney, who has a book called You Are Not So Smart and a great podcast on the subject. And he kind of breaks down a bias per episode in some ways. And there's things like survivorship bias, the famous story of the bombers that came back from the front in World War II, riddled with bullets. And a bunch of mathematicians figured out where to put the armor. And one mathematician said, no, you idiots, put the armor where there's no bullet holes because those planes didn't make it back. Mm. There's all kinds of bias like this, and there's some really neat parlor tricks. One of my favorite, and this is a really cool story, is called Benford's Law. Now, Leslie, imagine that I have 9 buckets in front of you, numbered 1 to 9. And I go through your bank records. We'll ask why in another episode.
Oh, I love this.
And every transaction, so every transaction that I find, I take the first digit. So if I see that you bought something for $1,200, I take a 1. If I see something you bought for $47, I take a 4. And I put that in bucket number 1 or bucket number 4. And I could do the same thing with the house numbers on streets or the length of rivers. You might think that each of those buckets would have an even number of things in them, right? That there'd be the same number of things that began with number 1 as began with number 9. It turns out that's not the case. For almost any physical or mathematical process described by a power law, 30% of the things will begin with a number 1. 17.5% begin with number 2. Only 4.8% begin with a number 9. So your bucket number 1 is overflowing and number 9 is almost empty. And you think, how can this be? Well, when Greece was being admitted to the European Union, someone looked at the data they were providing and said, wait, this doesn't fit Benford's law. And you could almost blame Brexit on the fact that nobody looked at Benford's law, right? And I think these kinds of like mathematical parlor tricks need to become much more commonplace for people to understand, how do I know the data is fake? And this is a place where we are not going to win an asymmetric war against algorithms unless we have algorithms on our side. I think it's time that we have AI used by us rather and for us rather than on us.
Yeah, so that's interesting, that notion. I mean, it does seem indeed very foreign. Why is it that the numbers are distributed that way? And indeed, that's a topic for another day. But the fact that you can turn around and say, all right, this data is clearly fake because it doesn't conform.
And I mean, it's not just like the biases that you have. It's also how you verify it. Qualitative research is great. I love the example of Google Ventures considering investment in Theranos. And there were thousands of breathless investors who could not wait to put money behind Elizabeth Holmes. One of the VCs at Google Ventures sent an intern to the local pharmacy to give blood. I love the fact that they found an intern to do it. And when they returned, they said, how are you feeling? And the intern's like, I'm kind of dizzy. I just lost a lot of blood. And Google said, no, I'm going to pass. Like, we forget that you can go verify this stuff. Go Google it, you know, look at the person's bio. It's trivially easy to at least do a cursory verification that will turn up 95% of the fakery in the world. We just don't take the time to do it. So if you've collected the data from sources that you trust, and then you're aware of your biases in analyzing it. And Alexa, I like your question of like Sagan saying, what else could it be? Mm-hmm. What else could be causing this? Just like taking that moment, sort of mindful data consumption. Then you can sort of take that data and understand the behavior of systems. So I'll give you an example of that. Most of us aren't thinking about putting data in a data storage system. Most of us are just thinking about how to remember and share things. But if you go into Google Photos, I have a photo of Barack Obama in there. I just took a screenshot somewhere or whatever, and it's in my Google Photos. And when I go into Google Photos, it shows me the picture of Obama and says, who's this? So on the one hand, you're like, come on, Google, how do you not know what Obama is? How do you not know that one of the most recognizable faces of the 21st century? On the other hand, Google doesn't know that I know who that is. And so Google Photos has not labeled that person as Barack Obama until I tell it this photo is the same as public figure Barack Obama, at which point it now has permission to label everything. Mm. So Google had to think hard about what it could label, because if I had a bunch of photos and all of a sudden Google starts labeling them, and now Google is showing me that I know these people, or maybe it thinks I know Obama because he's in my photo thing rather than it being a screenshot, it's going to make a whole bunch of scary inferences. So policy around what machines are allowed to know and how we let them know what we know so they can help us is very poorly defined.
Clearly, to state the obvious, you've thought a lot about this.
But a little bit.
But it leaves me wondering a little bit, what got you into this space? Was there a particular event or set of events where you felt like you had slid down the hill the wrong way? Or what piqued your interest in, you know, Why focus here in life?
So I think the fascinating things in the world happen where the rubber of technology meets the road of humanity. Mm-hmm. But there was a moment in 2012 when I wrote a blog post that got a lot more attention than I thought. OkCupid, which is a dating site, had a series of posts called Words White People Like. And what they did was they looked at all of the posts, because on OkCupid, you identify your race and your gender. And they said, are there words that stand out more in a particular profile? So for example, if you're a white male, then words like Tom Clancy, Van Halen, golfing, Ghostbusters, The Big Lebowski, brew, hockey, grilling, these appear much more in people's dating profiles, confirming everything you think about white men.
And they can not do walks same. On the beach or
well, no, but grilling, like, if you look at the like the Boston Bruins, it turns out is white women. And even there's some sampling bias. We keep talking about Boston here, but OkCupid had a lot of users in Boston. So guess what? There's bias, right? Now let's say I run an ad on Facebook. I'm a bank and I want to do a credit card promotion. And I decide that I'm going to run an ad and it's going to target fans of The Big Lebowski. And it gives you no interest-free credit card for a year. There's a law called the Fair Housing Act of 1968 that was designed to end redlining, which was the practice of drawing lines around Black, predominantly Black communities, and denying them borrowing at banks. It's one of the most progressive pieces of legislation ever enacted. But if I run an ad that gives credit card discounts to people who like The Big Lebowski, maybe I just violated the Fair Housing Act of 1968, even though I didn't explicitly say this ad is targeted at white men. And so we live in this world where data is so abundant, it becomes a proxy for identity. And I wrote this post about big data being a civil rights problem, and the response kind of exploded. Some people were like, what's a loud white dude talking about civil rights for? But most people were like, hey, this is a serious problem. And there was a professor at Oxford who wrote a response to it that he called, nobody knows the offer they didn't see. Mm. I think one of the most important things about data science and critical thinking is that we have to give algorithmic recourse. The difference between a human and a machine is that a human should have recourse. They should have a button to flag it or ask why or escalate to a human, whether we're talking about a judgment that's been happening on a traffic ticket or some legislation or whatever. And until we recognize that that recourse to algorithmic decisions is a human right, we will have and properly staff that recourse, we are going to continue to have a digital divide between those the algorithm doesn't like and those that the algorithm helps.
In fact, it's interesting you mentioned recourse. One of the episodes that I think were just released today with Kathleen Creel of Stanford, she talks about the need for having an audit capability to AI and algorithms so that you can actually, much like you audit financial records, you know, is what you're saying, is it doing what you're saying it's doing, right? And how? Do you think that's a part of it as well when you're talking about recourse?
So I think explainability for the designers of algorithms is vital because algorithms tend to drift. They tend to collect moss over time.
Yeah.
Everything has entropy. The amazing Susan Entlinger first pointed me at Word2Vec and the fact that we have trained algorithms on language data. One of my favorite parlor tricks to show people data science is to get them to pull out their phone and type in my friend is a nurse. And in fact, your listeners can do it right now if they want.
And they say she.
And it says she, exactly. Mm. And that's on the one hand, a very good prediction because 87% of nurses are female. And so, hey, good job. Based on normative data, good job algorithm. Mm-hmm. You figured out that there's an 87% chance the next word is she. On the other hand, that's probably not the future we want. We want to tell people what they can and can't do based on their gender or their religion or their race or their sexual orientation. So it's not a very good recommendation from a formative perspective. And so knowing the data sets on which things are trained is part of explainability. But I think for the general public, it also has to be much simpler. It has to be like the like button on Facebook or the report button when someone's doing something inappropriate. There needs to be a way to say, because I think that we're very familiar with office suites. And those office suites have a bunch of common properties. Every office suite has a copy and a paste function. Mm. We're about 5 years away from every office suite having a go function. where you just start typing and hit go and it finishes your essay for you and then you go edit it. Or you hit go and it tries to come up with images for your slides. We're already seeing some of these features leaking into tools like Microsoft's Office Suite.
Or actually you just say a bunch of like words and it formats them into a sentence, an idea or a query. That's already in Google.
Absolutely. And Google is already doing stuff where it's like looking at your spreadsheet and making suggestions for ways you might want to analyze rows. We are not going to get AI like someone flipping on a light switch. We're going to get AI by 1,000 tiny cuts. And we won't realize that it has already happened to us. I mean, I'm already a very different creature from what I was when I was born. I have immediate geolocation. I have awareness of world events within seconds. That's a totally different creature. And our brain has taken millennia to evolve. We are, you know, as every citizen is trying to catch up to this thing, we need to learn these new skills very quickly because we haven't had time to evolve them. And fortunately, we have the brain plasticity of humans, which is incredible. That's like our strongest feature. But we have to teach people to think critically, and then we have to build systems that allow them recourse and investigation and drilling down and so on. And there are people who would do us harm that don't want that to be possible.
It's a little bit like, you know, being afraid of government because government is ruling your lives and you don't understand, you don't understand how to get out from under the thumb.
I think the first answer there is fewer people under the thumb would mean less mistrust of government. And certainly if you are a citizen of many Western democracies, you might feel like you're under a thumb, but there is definitely this thing happening where we are trying to fix the balance between the individual and the collective. Some cultures have what are called flouting behaviors where they ignore leadership and advice. And some cultures have compliance behaviors where they tend to follow it. And one of the few salves that I have when over the last year or so, I've seen my fellow humans do very stupid things at scale that could have put a pandemic to rest in 5 or 6 weeks if we'd all followed instructions, but did not do so, is that human ingenuity is what got us here and what will help us. But there's a side effect of ingenuity. You're familiar with sickle cell anemia. Well, sickle cell anemia is a horrible disease, but it is a side effect of malarial resistance. So sickle cell anemia in certain races produces or the conditions that make people resistant to malaria sometimes produce sickle cell anemia. The conditions that make humans dumb, that make us ignore collectivism and common wisdom and the known way, are also what give us inventions. There's a famous line that the Wright brothers didn't have a pilot license. The people who I see walking down the street, not wearing masks, ignoring stuff, you know, fomenting unrest within the government, they're a side effect. They're the sickle cell anemia of human ingenuity, because human ingenuity is about breaking with the norm and trying something new and unproven and unconventional. Most of the great breakthroughs came from people who did not like the status quo. And so I think we have to accept as a superorganism that we have the critical thinking equivalent of sickle cell anemia, but it's a side effect of our ability to reinvent ourselves and try new things, which is necessary for evolution.
That is such an interesting way to look at it. And it's a great way, because every time I saw those people, you know, I would just get so riled up because I would think about the impact that they're having, you know, on the rest of us. But what you're saying is that's a price to pay for all the advances that we've made.
Before you move on, also, I think it's potentially an indication of bias as well, because, you know, whenever we see the news reports of all those overcrowded beaches and, you know, all these people acting badly, it's like we immediately project that most of the world is doing these really ridiculous things, when in fact, news reports are often going for the examples of the outrageous. So,
Absolutely. The news outlets are very incented to cover the outrage because that gets some clicks, because that's the economic system. I mean, we have some, we don't have time to get into this, but I think we are a decade away from every country having a state-run media platform that is approved and, you know, that is the thing that you can trust. And that there will be penalties on that platform for doing things that are bad. I think that we're going to see a sort of digital sovereignty happen. The fact that we are moving from a physical world, like if I want to speak freely, I can stand on a soapbox and yell as loud as my vocal cords will let me. And that's a right enshrined in most Western liberal constitutions. I don't have those rights in a digital world. I can't get up and stand on a digital soapbox because someone can disconnect me. They can object to me. I don't have an internet connection built into my brain. So my ISP can unplug me and so on. We haven't grappled with the idea that digital rights exist at the pleasure of other organizations, mostly those with commercial incentives. I would frankly rather a government elected by me, who is accountable to me, guarantee me some kind of digital footprint with consequences for abusing it. But we haven't gotten there yet, and it's going to take some massive disasters. I mean, electoral interference and so on, before we realize that. And so I'm worried, but also I think it's likely that our inability to think critically about data will lead to sovereign social platforms and government-run vehicles for free speech to enshrine those rights for our digital selves.
I think that's really interesting, though. It really presumes a massively educated electorate and a benign engaged. Yeah. And a benign sovereign power that is not beholden to, you know, private interests or, you know, very, and this is what we don't have right now. You had mentioned something about the Theranos, which I thought was so interesting, because I remember that one of the draws for Theranos, or for all of these companies being involved, was they had a stellar board of directors. You know, George Shultz, former Secretary of State, was on the board of directors. And again, going back to Carl Sagan, one of the things he railed against was as a pitfall was trusting authority. And let me make a distinction, not authority, not experts, but authority. And that so often, and not even in terms of data science, but just now in terms of critical thinking, we don't realize sample bias. We get our information from surveys, but we don't really ask, you know, how is this sampled? Is this representative of the general population? Or some authority gets on the news and tells us that we should ingest, you know, hydroxyquinone or whatever it was, and they're not an expert, but because they're no authority, we do that. If you had to take this down to a very basic level and you said, okay, when we're thinking about data and the information that we're consuming, what are the rules that we ought to live by so that we avoid these pitfalls, what would you suggest?
So I think in the Theranos case, we were using the reputation of the board of directors as a proxy for scientific information and inquiry.
Proxy metrics.
And I believe they're the kind of people that would not endorse such things without checking. Mm-hmm. Then I believe it. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing, is a lot of people aren't as smart as you think they are just because of their titles. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a really important question to ask of any algorithmic decision, which is, what is its objective function? The objective function of an algorithm is the thing it's trying to optimize for. So if you want to try to get people to stay on a website as long as possible, your objective function is engagement time. I'll give you a good example. Twitter knows that if you sign up for Twitter and you follow a certain number of people who follow you back within 7 days, you'll become a regular user. Hmm. As a designer of Twitter's algorithms, you then don't show just people that are interesting for me to follow. You show people who are interesting for me to follow who will follow me back, because that's the leading indicator of the behavior I want. And so if we know the objective function of Twitter is to produce long-term engaged users, then we can figure out why I'm being shown certain people. We don't spend a lot of time asking, why is the sausage being made? Like, we don't want to know how the sausage is made, but there's no way to hide from the business reason for something to exist. One of the examples I think we haven't ever touched on because it's taboo is porn. The vast majority of pornographic content on the internet is free. There's a tremendous amount of bandwidth and hosting cost for that. There have been cases of people injecting malware into adult content ads. There's probably an immense amount of information being collected on citizens and their peccadillos. And unless we move to a world where we stop kink shaming and we recognize that everybody's a freak, there is probably going to be an apocalypse of porn when we find out that half those sites were operated by foreign governments and have been collecting data and are now blackmailing senators. Hmm. We don't talk about that at all. We start talking about this stuff. The difference between who we say we are online and who we actually are online is vastly different. And so I think that part of this is going to be coming to terms with the idea that we are a new species. One of the things that gives me great hope is that the younger generation, the sort of creator economy, as it were, has become much more digitally native. They can still be misled and so on, but we've eliminated most of the middlemen. In most cases, a creator can go to their consumers. You're seeing this from Patreon to Substack to many of their platforms like this. And that kind of clarifies the motives, because when you have a lot of middlemen and markups and lock-in contracts and commissions, and that gets very sort of confusing and Byzantine to unravel. And so I think that if we have a digitally literate next generation that is much more directly connected, then the big question is, what are the platforms doing? But at least there's one platform to happen. And I think it's likely to see a tremendous amount of regulation of those platforms in terms of transparency and accountability and data export and the ability to move from platform to platform freely. That's where I think we're going to see heavy legislation in the coming decade.
Well, I really feel like we've popped the hood on a number of online platforms and information in our world today. And it's been a fascinating exploration. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Thank you so much, Alistair. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.